Welcome to AZMCast, a peer-reviewed, evidence-based podcast heavily seasoned with expert opinion. For all you new listeners, I'm going to give you a quick tutorial on how to use this podcast to its fullest potential. For you faithful veterans, you can go ahead and skip ahead to the good stuff. As you listen to this podcast, you'll hear contributors give opinions on everything from practice styles to diagnostic evaluations to emergency medicine philosophy. When you hear the bell ding, that means that the opinion is backed by evidence. Check your screen on your device to see the referenced paper, and we suggest taking a screenshot for future reading. When you hear the turkey gobble, that's just our opinion, and you can decide whether you want to take it or leave it. Hi, everybody, and welcome to the March episode of AZMCast. This month on the podcast, we have the culmination of our marathon coverage of procedural sedation in the ED. We're joined by Dr. Clay Joseffi and Dr. Mike McLaughlin, two of our alumni from the University of Arizona, now in the Lake Tahoe area. They provide such great perspective with their peer review that we will have half of their peer review on this episode and half in April. But first, I wanted to read something that I sent out to our residents. Morale ebbs and flows in the ED. Our job is full of high highs and low lows. The saving grace of emergency medicine is that every shift ends. No matter how bad the shift, no matter how busy it is, or what awful thing we may see, we all know that our shift will end. Once it ends, we can go home to our coping mechanisms. A partner, children, a pet, a workout, a hike, a climb, a restaurant, a club, sleep, church, family, friends, whatever it is for you. This job can be rough, so everyone needs some person, routine, or activity that lifts them up and restores their humanity. But this shift hasn't ended. It's at work, it's on the news, it's in your email, it's on your social media feeds. It's all everyone can talk about. And we can't seem to escape it, and it's affected our ability to cope normally. And not only do we not know enough about this pandemic, but we don't know when life will return to normal. We know morale is low, we're all running on empty, and we need this shift to end. So I encourage you to find a way to end it, even if it's only briefly. Laugh at a movie or a meme, go outside for a run if you're able to, have drinks with friends over FaceTime, look at the thousands of pictures you've taken over the last year, work on a project you've been putting off, even if it's only for an hour. Find a place of peace and rest, and then get back out there to fight. Even though this is the longest shift of your life, every shift ends. We will get back to normal with your help and your hard work. Take care of yourselves and each other. Keep your head up. Recognize that to the rest of the world, you are heroes. And even heroes need to give themselves time to grieve and recover. So with all of these great sedations that we have, you know, they're good drugs, but they're all general. They are total body sedatives. They are total patient sedatives. And so if you can avoid using these, it's preferable. But there are even some of the things that you can do to avoid you should be doing during your sedations. So the things that you should be doing are certainly distraction and local anesthetics. So for distraction, if you can get someone focused on something else, not the fact that they're freaked out about going into this tube, then maybe you don't need a whole smack of Versed to calm them down. If you can get somebody who's getting an LP focused on something else, maybe they won't need a whole lot of general sedative. With the local anesthetics, we use the topical combination of lidocaine, epinephrine, and tetracaine that I will put on foreheads all the time. And I'll sew up a two-year-old who's watching the iPad with the LET gel on their forehead, and I don't need any sedation. So these are great. If you're doing a moderate sedation where they're still kind of awake to verbal cues, then keep in mind that keeping somebody else talking to them, having them focused on something, having child life to meet with them and talk to them through the procedure, playing with an iPad, doing something like this for children is really useful. And then using local anesthetic will decrease the amount of general anesthetic that you're going to need. So if you don't numb them up and you give them something like propofol or midazolam that doesn't have pain control properties, you're going to be using a lot. But if you give them a little whiff and then you give them some local anesthesia, they're not going to feel what you're doing, so they're not going to be stimulated, and you don't have to use as much general. So using local or regional anesthetic is always indicated if you're going to be doing a procedure that will tolerate that.
Right. Don't use it as an either or. I feel like, well, I'm sedating him. I don't need to do any local. And I'm like, you're an idiot. But I mean, seriously, I mean,
surgeons will use local anesthetic in the OR with the patient intubated and paralyzed.
Right. And part of it's, you know, it's not just while the procedure happens, it's the wake up period. Mm-hmm. So you've repaired a LAC or you've relocated something, you know, they're still going to have pain at that site. You did that hematoma block, you put some lidocaine at the fracture site because it hurts. And when, even if it's splinted and reduced, it feels better, it still hurts. And so buying some extra time to block some of those receptors and decrease that pain response is huge. And we know if we stop some of these acute trauma pain responses, we're going to decrease their chance for a long-term, you know, opiate need or pain control, and we'll decrease their chance for even like complex regional pain syndrome, those things. So having that upfront local control, the kids, the adults, they're all going to be so much happier going forward.
Definitely. And, you know, just going back to the pharmacokinetics on these agents, even if you're doing a sedation, you're talking about 10, 15, maybe 30 minutes where, you know, you've got them completely out. Whereas if you do a block or if you instill some lidocaine, you're going to get a lot longer duration of effect. So that's a really good point.
2 to 6 hours more than what you're doing otherwise.
Absolutely.
So I think that a lot of us take our procedural sedation for granted in the ED. But this has come under fire in the past, as a lot of things that we would like to do in the ED starts to evolve and grow. We want to do more bedside ultrasound. We want to do procedural sedations. We want to do esophageal echoes for cardiac arrest. I mean, some of the stuff that we think will help, sometimes we step on other people's turf and their territories. And this was a big problem in, I think, the late 2000s, early 2010s, of where at that time, and still true in most places, the Department of Anesthesiology are the drug czars, so to speak. They control what different hospitals can use, different departments can use. For most credentialing, wherever you go, you're going to have to pass a test, usually written or at least administered by the Department of Anesthesia, to show that you're actually competent to provide sedation. Now, it's part of pretty much every emergency doctor's credentialing. It's part of all of our residency training, and it's something that we all should feel comfortable with. But it's something that I wouldn't take for granted, because there were institutions like CMS and the Joint Commission and other national institutions that said, I don't think ER doctors should be allowed to do this. And I think one of the first things that butted up against that was, well, then you're going to have to come in and do it. And go, well, all right, fine. But you can only use these drugs. And as happens with most hospital-based policies, a policy is based off of one bad outcome. And so if all your hospital will let you use are the more potentially dangerous drugs like fentanyl and midazolam, then it's probably going to propagate more bad outcomes. So this is something that you can do at a local level and talk with your hospital about what's safe, review the literature, and try to prevent some of this from falling back on us.
Yeah, each place that you go, different hospitals will have different credentialing packets for your sedation. You may have to apply for propofol separately than applying for Versed. I was at places that midazolam was considered procedural sedation. You could not give midazolam at all, and otherwise you had to fill out forms, even like 1 milligram. Can you imagine giving 1 milligram of midazolam and having to do a sedation and you're doing pharyngealitis? So you can, and at the same place, propofol was fine. So you can get all different kinds of combinations because you don't know where these places are, and you don't know, like Aaron said, who are the czars on top of that. One of the things to combat that would be get involved with your local hospital, getting on the pharmacy board, getting on the sedation committee, being part of, you know, if you're on P&T committee, being part of those committees, you can have a little bit of an influence, and it may not be a big influence right away, but you can help protect, and over time you can show the competencies that we have with these agents, and so that they do feel more comfortable. Because as Aaron said, like anesthesia doesn't want to keep coming to the ER to do every sedation, nor do they want to take every sedation to the OR that we call for them. And it's not just us. Then they would have to take all the ortho cases and all the general surgery, and it'd be like, oh my gosh, this is, they want to go home and spend time with their family. So just be wary that, you know, this is, like anything, a credentialing issue, certain places, and a threat that could be taken away. So become involved, be active, understand what your system does. And I think the more you take care and do good sedation and practice good things, not doing the thing like Chris is saying, and giving random doses and trying to sideline, you know, and skirt around. But when you start to get numbers, and most institutions, if you want to pull your data, have big numbers of how many sedations they've done and how safe they've been with very low complications or bad outcomes, that becomes real powerful when you go to your committees.
Absolutely. There was a recent set of guidelines that came out for procedural sedation that did not include emergency medicine physicians in the writing group. And there were a few articles that came out afterwards, editorials and things like that, where emergency medicine physicians were saying why they didn't participate, why the organization, I believe it was ASEP, didn't get involved with the writing group, and how they felt it was inappropriate for an external organization to basically try to dictate what can be done in emergency medicine. And one of the things that I think really helped is that there is a fairly robust body of literature now showing that this can be done safely. But as soon as you start seeing those adverse effect rates start to creep up, get out of line with other providers that are doing similar sedations, it becomes harder and harder to justify. So I think that keeping these safe practices in place, not only is it really good for patients, but it's also good for helping to protect the ability to continue to do procedural sedation in the department. Mm-hmm.
All right, real quick, sedation stories.
Sorry. Oh, this is the best. So we had a guy who came in to get multiple abscesses drained, and we were preparing to do a sedation with ketamine. And I went in to give the patient my spiel. So, you know, we're going to give you a drug. It's going to make you feel a little bit weird. It's called ketamine. He goes, is it like human ketamine? Then I'm like, yeah, it is. And then he's like, oh, cool, man. Because I was getting drug tested for work, and I would go down to Mexico and get simian ketamine, and that stuff was really good. So I can only imagine what the human ketamine is going to be like. And this guy is the only patient I've ever met who could absolutely handle ketamine. So we gave him a fully dissociative dose. He had full-on nystagmus, and he was just talking in slow motion. But he was still absolutely aware of everything that was going on around him. He didn't mind that we drained his abscesses, though, so it all worked out. But
ketamine, man.
Ketamine.
Ketamine's a hell of a drug.
Absolutely.
Hello, Arizona Emergency Medicine Podcast crew. This is Clay Josephy and Dr. McLaughlin coming back to the podcast. It's a real honor to be back. We're coming to you live from beautiful South Lake Tahoe, California.
Thank you, Clay. And thank you, Arizona Emergency Medicine Podcast, for inviting us back. It's really an honor to share our experience with you guys. We appreciate the invitation. And again, my name is Mike McLaughlin. I graduated from University of Arizona Emergency Medicine Residency in 2008. I've been practicing here in South Lake Tahoe since 2011.
And I am Clay Josephy. I graduated from U of A in 2010. And I also have been practicing here since. This has been the my single job in my career. So now we've been here for quite a while. We're like old pieces of furniture. Once again, you guys have sort of taken on another doozy of an endeavor. You really know how to do deep dives, and I like that about the AZEM podcast specifically. This topic, procedural sedation and analgesia in the ED, is so important. This is just essential to emergency medicine. And, you know, you guys kind of made a little bit of a joke how this has been sort of a horse that has been beaten, you know, in the foam ed and in the podcastosphere. But I kind of disagree. I really think that you guys have done a really extraordinary thing here, just real deep dive and gone through, you know, the real nuts and bolts of sedation, which is so important to emergency medicine.
A deep dive in a practical standpoint is how I would describe it.
Yeah.
This isn't a literature review, but rather, like Clay had said, a review of the nuts and bolts of procedural sedation and how we get it done.
Yeah, lots of pearls in here. I really think this is a must listen for all emergency physicians. To get started, you guys covered so much material. I think we'll start by just saying, you know, procedural sedation, or just sedation, analgesia, anxiolysis, it's arguably the most important part of emergency medicine. You know, all of our patients have pain. All of our patients are scared. At some level, you just need to be the absolute expert in this. So I think it really behooves, you know, emergency medicine trainees to really sit down with this material and listen to this podcast a couple times and really get dialed in on all of it. So having said that, I think starting point, I think the most important thing about procedural sedation and analgesia in the emergency department is knowing when you don't need it and knowing when you can perform a painful procedure with alternative mechanisms. And that's been something we've really learned a lot about over the years, just being single practice, single coverage attendings.
Exactly. We do practice primarily in a single covered environment. And from a resource utilization standpoint, we just cannot sedate all patients. I've learned to do most of my shoulder reductions, for instance, without sedation. Mm. Whereas in residency, I sedated all of those patients. I certainly appreciated the opportunity to learn how to sedate patients by doing shoulders, but it's just not practical where we work. I do most of my distal radius fractures with some fentanyl and a hematoma block. We also work at ski clinics, which is a really great opportunity. With one nurse and one doctor, it's really impractical to sedate almost any patients there. If it needs to be done, it needs to be done, but you need to learn how to alternative methods to getting the job done without torturing the patient.
Right. And this is not exactly torturing. This is not torturing. It's amazing what you can perform using, you know, nerve blocks, intra-articular therapies, distraction, you know, other non-pharmacological hematoma blocks, joint blocks like the trimal fracture of the ankle. The joint block is phenomenal. Elbow dislocations, the joint block is phenomenal. This is not torturing your patients. This is actually learning how to do these procedures comfortably without, you know, wiping them out with propofol. I have to say, like, that's been, you know, one of the most important evolutions of my own practice, is just really learning how to treat a lot of these painful procedures and doing these procedures without having to use deep sedation.
That being said, especially earlier in your career as you're honing these techniques, if you need to sedate the patient, you need to sedate the patient. And I would echo what Clay said. This isn't about torturing patients. This isn't the Brutane method.
Don't replace it with suffering.
Exactly. This is learning alternative methods and doing right by the patient, but also utilizing your resources correctly in the emergency department.
Yeah, absolutely. So one thing I really liked about the podcast is the way that you started at the beginning, you know, with the policy and procedure stuff and pre-sedation and monitoring and personnel and regulatory stuff and paperwork and all the sort of safety net that we employ, you know, that gets sort of brushed over from time to time. And it's very important, I think, for all, you know, EPs to really get a handle on the policy and procedure side of things, because it does receive a bit of a disproportionate, probably unsubstantiated amount of attention from, you know, say, regulatory bodies and JCO and site surveys. I've had a bit of a unique experience in that I've been sort of the sedation guy in our group for years. And we started, you know, when I started working here and when Mike started working here, we like had no sedation privileges. We weren't allowed to use propofol. Over the years now, we have now deep sedation and procedural sedation is a core privilege. There are no requirements whatsoever to have this as long as you're board certified. So I just wanted to echo a lot of what the importance of what you guys were talking about. and when it comes to the policy and the procedure stuff and really knowing the nuts and bolts, I do want to say, you know, if you're working in a hospital that has sort of obstructive policies to the delivery of procedural sedation, specifically deep sedation in the ED, you just have to change it. You have to get on the committees. I mean, CMS says specifically that emergency physicians are credentialed at every level of sedation. They also say that you should be using ACEP guidelines. ACEP guidelines are very clear now. Over the last 10 years, have published just about everything you need in order to make your own policies and to just really reduce any sort of restrictions on these on this procedure. You guys talk about privileging and credentialing at some point in the podcast, and I just wanted to point out that you really shouldn't have any procedural credential requirements or competency requirements anymore. You know, ACEP has come out and has said clearly that emergency physicians with board certification, and I quote, should be credentialed without additional requirements for procedural sedation, you know, unquote. So you really are at a time where you can make your own policies. But I do agree very strongly with your guys' message that as painful as some of these processes may come across, like in real time, you know, the paperwork and the consents and the everything else and the yada yada, it's very important as a safety mechanism.
It is something that every emergency physician is trained to do, and we all get that. But don't take the privilege at the hospital for granted. Fentanyl and Versed sucks.
Yeah.
I can speak from experience. Take it seriously every time. Follow the rules. Do the same preparation every time, you know, to ward off those evil spirits. Do it the right way every time. Don't cut corners.
It's essential. I mean, I don't even know how you can get through a shift without the privilege. I mean, I remember distinctly having, you know, before the privileges were actually allowed, I had this case that sort of brought it all into a focus for me. I had like this young kid with the both forearm fracture in the middle of the night. It was like 11 o'clock at night. And he had eaten something an hour before. I wasn't allowed to sedate him. I called anesthesia and they're like, yeah, we'll do it in 6 hours in the OR, you know? And I'm just like, nope, like things have to change. So if you're in a hospital that's doing that kind of stuff, you can also change it. You just have to get on the committee. You got to do the work and you got to be diligent. You know, the two person thing and having two people at the bedside is a big deal. There are hospitals out there, and I don't know how many anymore, but this was a pretty big deal not long ago where a lot of hospitals would require two doctors to be at the bedside. And that's, you know, I mean, I get it. Like, it makes sense intuitively, but it's just not an option in most of the settings. And specifically in our setting, it just didn't work. Like, we would get so many delays. We had a policy for quite some time where we had to have two doctors. You know, it's not two people, but two doctors, plus the nurse and everything else. So, you know, single doc or single doc, single nurse sedations is a bit of a liberty and a privilege, but it's certainly doable. And we've actually arrived at that. We went through this whole process and developed a single doc policy. And we, you know, we actually published our own data in American Journal of Emergency Medicine. And, you know, Brian does a good job of talking about all the variations in practice. But, you know, these things where you don't have a bunch of doctors around and residents and, you know, we don't call, for example, in our setting, we don't call orthopedics to do the procedure very often. We never call anesthesia to do the sedation, almost never. So it's really important to have a policy in place that you can do the procedure. The nurse can monitor the sedation. You guys can do it together. You can get RT on board, you know, whatever else, end-tidal CO2 is required. But you got to have a, you know, depending on your situation, you got to have a policy that allows you to deliver this care easily.
Absolutely. Speaking from experience, the two doctor policy does not work very well, especially in a single coverage setting. It's going to be difficult to get an orthopedic surgeon or a specialist or anesthesia into the emergency department in the middle of the night.
They're busy.
Just to bang out a procedure. Being able to administer the sedation and to do the procedure with a single physician is key.
It's kind of funny. It's been a bit of a circus over the last decade, just some of the ironies and the ridiculous, you know, scrutiny that is placed on this from the regulators. But I think things are changing. I think emergency medicine has sort of arrived at a place where we're recognized specialists in sedation at all levels. And I think it's time for all of us to kind of take control of that. So, you know, get on the committees. Make it a core privilege. Be vigilant about the process. Don't cut corners. Do the monitoring. Do the paperwork. I know it's arduous, but it's important, and it also does ensure safety. You guys kind of jump around after this and talk a little bit. We'll just say a couple things about things that you brought up. NPO and fasting, that's actually kind of a thing as well, a sticking point with regulators. you know, if your hospital is enforcing ASA guidelines for NPO and fasting, you have to change it. I mean, ASEP has its own guideline, which is totally acceptable according to, you know, national regulatory bodies, and it's more reasonable.
I really don't think about NPO.
Yeah, I don't think about it at all. We don't have a policy.
I ask because I'm supposed to.
Yeah, we have we use the ASEP policy, and I agree. Over the years, I really don't think about this part very much anymore.
So I asked the question because I'm supposed to.
Mm-hmm. And there's a checkbox on the paperwork.
I would agree that if the patient just had a cheeseburger and fries, you know, waiting an hour is usually not that big of a deal for me. I do what I need to do when I need to do it, and I don't give a lot of thought to this NPO status.
Yeah, as far as aspiration, I do. Brian said this as well. He brought it up a couple times about sitting the patient up. I like that. I sit pretty much all the patients up that I can during the procedure and during the sedation. Definitely is good form to sit the patient up. Get their head, you know, supported so that their airway doesn't, you know, so they don't drop their chin and obstruct their upper airway, and just keep an eye on it.
Absolutely. I would agree. If the procedure allows, I always like to have the head of the bed up a little bit.
The next thing you guys talk about, which is you guys did such a good job. It's a subjective thing. A lot of variation among emergency physicians. But who is a candidate? You know, who would you sedate? I think you guys kind of looked at it as who wouldn't you sedate? And, you know, I don't know. I guess this kind of depends. Everybody's got their own threshold. I mean, what about you, Mike? They said under 60, under 70. Do you think that's, I mean, I don't know. I don't think of an age criteria really is what I'm looking for when I decide.
Correct. I don't have any kind of age cutoff. It depends on the patient, what their comorbidities are, and how serious those comorbidities are. I've sedated plenty of patients over the age of 80 who are reasonably healthy for their age to get the procedure done. So I don't have any kind of age cutoff. It just depends on the patient. I kind of consider the procedure that I'm doing and the patient, whether or not I'm comfortable sedating them, completely separately. There are plenty of patients that I can sedate, but I cannot do the procedure because I don't have the expertise in doing it, or it's going to be too laborious for me to do it, going to take me too long to do it. Those patients need to go somewhere else to get the procedure done, whether or not I can sedate them. And there are rare patients for me who I've declined to sedate. I can recall one patient in the last 24 months or so that I declined to sedate. It was an older person who had a prosthetic hip dislocation. So we wanted to get it back in, but it could wait. And this guy was not a picture of health. He was on 3 or 4 liters of oxygen all the time. He had pretty bad COPD, pulmonary hypertension. He had some cardiomyopathy with a low ejection fraction. I remember it was below 30%. And I stepped back and I thought about it. I'm not sedating this guy. But that's really uncommon for me. I can recall 2 instances in the last 7 or 8 years where I've declined to sedate the patient because of their health. I think most patients with what we're doing, we can safely sedate them.
Yeah, I agree. And I don't, you know, you guys also made the point of like, is this patient going home? I don't think that plays in very often. I think there's plenty of patients who you want to sedate and do a procedure who are subsequently going to get admitted for surgery, or, you know, maybe they're an AF, new onset AF, but they're having a little bit of chest pain that you want to, you know, admit them for a stress test. I mean, there's plenty of patients who get admitted. Most go home, admittedly, but I wouldn't use that either as a criteria. We do a lot of cardioversion for atrial fibrillation. It actually represents about a third of our sedations in our department, which is pretty surprising given the volume of orthopedics that we see. But the atrial fibrillation patients and the hip dislocations are typically elderly patients. And having reviewed like the quality data for this project at our hospital, like definitely like all the patients who get BVM are either hips or older people getting cardioversion. They're all kind of older comorbidities. So, you know, the age thing is, it is a thing. And when you have these elderly patients, you definitely want to consider, you know, your dosages. And I tend to use pretty low doses in these patients. And, you know, adjuvant, you know, low-dose ketamine, for example, which is not going to contribute to respiratory depression. But in general, it's amazing. Like, we, in our data set, we have 90-year-olds who have received, you know, procedural sedation for whatever, hips and stuff. And so you just got to kind of trust your gut, I guess, and really follow the rules. The other thing is our patient population is pretty, I don't know, we're not seeing a lot of tertiary patients and patients with abnormal airways and a lot of, you know, syndromic kids and stuff. We see, I guess, anatomically and physiologically amenable patients. So we don't really turn many down, and we do a ton of sedations in our department. Definitely.
Good point.
Yeah.
some of those syndromic names that you mentioned.
You guys, well, I don't even know what you're...
It barely registered to me.
As soon as I saw
I saw that on the chart, I would be calling anesthesia.
Calling someone right as they hit the door, you know? But anyway, so that's just a little caveat. The other thing you guys brought up about resources and, you know, the quote, you know, quote unquote, the department has my patient. You guys are poking fun at Jared. I kind of fall with Jared on that one. It kind of gets annoying. I do think that, at least in our population, and I think is true of most times, most of these procedures that require sedation, they're pretty urgent. You know, like you need to prioritize them. Obviously, if you're doing CPR on somebody down the hallway, like it's not an option. And certainly as single coverage physicians, we run into this a lot where the sedation does have to be delayed. But you want to get in there and get it done. You know, we don't have open ORs. Our anesthesiologists are busy. You know, the orthopedists are busy. Like we can't, you know, a lot of times the ED is the ideal place to do this. And so the reason I'm bringing this up is because kind of going back to a previous point, it's just so important for you to really make a streamlined process that's efficient. And so you can really get these sedations done without these massive delays and nurses going all over the place and not being able to put your mind to it. So
absolutely. You have to remember that it's going to be more intensive as far as resources go and a lot more expensive to send the patient to the operating room.
Oh God, so much more expensive.
If they need to go to the operating room, they need to go. Don't get me wrong.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't send a patient to the operating room who could be otherwise sedated safely in the emergency department just because it was busy that day.
Yeah. Unless, you know, if it's catastrophic, it's catastrophic. We've all experienced, you know, the cats and dogs, you know, coming raining down and just all pandemonium is, but anyway, be aware that you are, you know, the expert. Like emergency physicians are now in 2020, the experts at doing these procedures and the sedations. So, I mean, most EDs are being asked by their cardiology colleagues to, you know, sedate their cardioversion cases, you know, and whatnot. And people are like coming from the other parts of the hospital to the ER to get sedated. So